Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Roadmap, an old school gaming podcast, where we explore how the games of the past brought us the games we love today. This episode we're going to look at the real-time strategy game genre, its basic origins, how it grew, and how it ended up spawning the MOBA genre that has become the juggernaut that it is today. So let's get right down into this. So to start with, let's look at some of the core concepts of real-time strategy games in general. The biggest one is squad control and squad management. So you take groups of units, or sometimes in the rare occasion, a single unit within a mission, and either destroy the enemy army, acquire an objective, defend your position for a certain length of time. Most of the time, there is some sort of mission basis to it, at least in the single-player content. There's also the multiplayer, which the mission, the quote-unquote mission, is just hinder or destroy your opponent's army in such a way that they have no hope of winning. The two other very common elements of the genre are resource gathering and base building. These are more in some of the later genres out there, the later elements of the genre. These are more in some of the later elements of the genre, but they become the foundation, especially of the competitive multiplayer scene, where you have to optimize your gathering, you have to optimize your base building in such a way that you get the biggest strength against your opponent. That's pretty much it for the basics of it. Everything from there kind of grows off of it. You get a few unique traits per game, but for the most part, there, if you have those, Matt, if you meet, say, three of the four, you have a real-time strategy game. Now, we can look in very deep detail into really what the first game to utilize real-time strategy elements was, but that's very shady, you can go here, you can go there, you can pick that. But the first game that really was widely acknowledged as being the birth of the genre as a whole was the licensed game from Westwood Studios, Doom 2. Now, this was released in 1992, and it was actually a sequel to a game from before it, obviously by the name Doom 2. But the game before it wasn't so much a strategy game as it was an adventure game. You had a lot of the conversation elements, you had the location hunting, you had the puzzle solving, and a little bit of a diplomacy factor there that were indicative and really defined it as an adventure game with almost a side element, a bit of a background element for most of the game of base and resource features. Now, this was Westwood really putting their stamp on the ground. This was them establishing this genre for what it was. They'd seen these elements in other games over the years, but they embraced it. They really said, hey, let's do something different. And it established everything that was to come. There's a reason that Westwood, throughout the 90s and the earlier part of the 2000s, were one of the big names in real-time strategy games until they were bought out and eventually dissolved by Electronic Arts. Now, the other big name that came onto the scene in the early 90s, in 1994, was Blizzard Studios. They came out with Warcraft. I'm going to trust a lot of people have at least heard of the Warcraft franchise to some extent. The very first one, Warcraft Orcs and Humans, it was a fantasy-based game, very heavily influenced by the likes of Tolkien, and especially Warhammer, which of course was itself inspired by Tolkien. One of the things I love about the Warcraft franchise is how much lore is built into it. Right from the very first game, there was a lot of it built from scratch, and the manuals, you'd get maybe half to a third of the manual, somewhere in that window, of the mechanics of the game, maybe including the technology trees in the game for you to research. The rest of it was all backstory. It was all legends and lore and everything built into it that you don't need to know to play the game, but definitely help make the world feel more fleshed out for you. Some of the interesting things that were introduced with the Warcraft games that weren't there in Doom 2, you had population limits that you managed by building more farms. So you actually had that resource to manage. So it wasn't just in Doom you had spice. Now you have the population, you have wood, you have gold, all those things. You have multiple resources that you need to pull on. One of the other things is, instead of it just being recolorings of the opposite team, so, you know, you have one side this color, one side that color, one side that color, here they actually had a cosmetic difference. If you were playing orcs or if you were playing humans, it was very clear. You could tell right away, you knew what you were going up against just by the look of the characters coming at you. And this is where really the multiplayer support starts coming in. They really start focusing more on multiplayer options, which also included maps designed specifically to create a balanced match. So in a campaign mission, you may have a little bit more resources heavy towards your corner of the map, maybe a few expansion points right near you, whereas your opponent would have almost nothing. They would allow the computer to either cheat or kind of balance it in your favor since you're playing through the story. This started the trend of having very balanced maps where it doesn't matter where you start on it, given the different starting points there are. It comes down to a matter of skill at that point, as opposed to just, oh, well, you got the better pick. Now, in 1995, just within a year of Warcraft coming out, Westwood came back onto the scene, and this is their own IP. This is something they developed from the ground up, and it became one of the two big franchises. This became Command & Conquer. This is obviously the game we're going to be covering in the next episode, so I'm not going to go into too deep a detail on this. But the basics were you had some slight unit differences in terms of how they played. Not heavy, but just slight. So whereas Warcraft, pretty much footmen versus grunts, you're going to have essentially the same stats. This one would tweak them slightly, so one guy may do better damage, but be a bit slower. The other side, it's going to be faster, lighter damage, but you can kind of swing in and out, do hit and run tactics. The fun thing they did with this, one of the things that I've always gotten a kick out of, was full motion video cutscenes, where you had live actors playing the different roles, just filmed on a green screen. Bit of CGI help with some of the cutscenes as well, especially the between mission cutscenes before you'd get to the next briefing. This one didn't have as much backstory in the manual. Later on in the franchise, they would add codec entries so you could learn a little bit more as you play through. But they still had a very deep story and a fleshed out world that they expressed through the cutscenes themselves. You'd see certain bits, you'd see little news reports and that really helped flesh out the world you're playing in and introduced it gradually instead of trying to dump it all on you right off the get-go. Another part is this became very heavy support for multiplayer. Not really supported nowadays, obviously, for most formats, only because you can't get online to play it. But you can still do LAN, and I also remember with my friends playing modem games as well back in the day. Now, for those of you that don't know, that means I would have to be on my computer, dial the phone number of my friend's other computer that would hopefully be listening for my call to come through. Basically an internet connection without going through our internet providers. So in 1997, a game called Age of Empires came out. This was another entry into the genre that took a bit of a different take on it. Instead of these massive fantasy universes, these fictional worlds that they came into, they tried to base these roughly in reality. Now, they didn't go 100% accurate, but what it did is it allowed you to advance from the Stone Age up through the Iron Age, and they allowed you to really build these civilizations from the ground up. What they did is they allowed you to pick a culture, pick a civilization, and build them up from the Stone Age right through to the Iron Age, and really establish them, build them, run a story with them as you're playing along. One of the interesting things is, as you advance through different ages, as you advance from the Stone Age up to a more agrarian society, your access to different resources altered slightly, so you could gather food from bushes or kill animals to start with, and in terms of hunting to get your food. Eventually you have the ability to build farms and turn to the agrarian society where you don't need to run all over the map looking for things, and it's the resource management at that point became getting the resources you needed to get to that point where you become more stable, more sufficient. You're not sending your very weak villagers out to possibly get gunned down in the middle of the field. The other interesting thing they did is that each culture you could play as, they had unique benefits and disadvantages. So you could have increased damage, but you may not have access to certain units or technology that would not make sense for your culture. So if you're playing, say, more of a British group, like something from the Northern European area, you won't have access necessarily to, say, an elephant cavalry that you would with, say, a Roman or a Greek soldier would. The other fun thing they did, the other very interesting thing they did, is that all of the buildings you have, depending on which region your culture's from, so if you have an Asian culture, a Greek culture, something like that, the look of the buildings was going to be different. So you may not know exactly what culture you're up against in a random multiplayer battle, but once you found some of their base, once you see one of their buildings, you at least have a rough idea of what category they're in, so as the playstyles shift, depending on all that, it allows you to kind of plan out what your strategy needs to be to counter all that. Now, in 1998, Blizzard came back onto the fold with a whole new universe, a whole new title for you to play, and this is StarCraft. And this game became such a seminal piece in the genre that I'm going to have to cover it as its own episode, just because there's so much that it brought to gaming in general. Some of the interesting things, obviously it's a new universe, it's a sci-fi universe. Now instead of lovingly acknowledging Warhammer, they're lovingly acknowledging Warhammer 40K. And the fun thing about this is you have three different factions, whereas all the other mainstays, all the other foundations of the genre at this point, you had two factions at best. Like I said, Age of Empires, it had more than two, but they still played very... You didn't have unique units, you didn't have overly unique strategies for them, you could just kind of leverage some of your skills. This one, each faction, you had Terrans, Zerg, and Protoss, all of them play uniquely, all of them have their own style, it's not just a cosmetic build. So the Zerg, you're very much fueled by hit-and-run tactics, you're overwhelming them with very small, weak units, but just a mass of them. Whereas, like, the Protoss, it's expensive to build your units, but they hit very hard, so it's... You start building around your strategies, both how to play your preferred race and how to counter the other races, depending on how you're playing against them. The other thing is, this really helped build esports in terms of a real-time strategy genre. Whether we include the fighting game community as a proper esport or not, that's up for debate, not because it's not a true competition, but because of how they like to define themselves. But this established esports, this really built it, especially in Korea. I think within the last year, it was officially run esports from major corporations It's not as much now, but at the same time, we're also approaching almost 20 years out from the launch of the game, so I think even 15 years would have been a pretty good run as a major esport title. As I said, this game is such a foundation of the genre that it bears looking at on its own, if only to look at the impact it's had. Now, at this point, we've really gotten into the 21st century, and it bears looking at a game that's kind of a mix, a hybrid, of both the turn-based and the real-time strategy genre, and that is Shogun Total War. Back in 2000, it was first released, and this established the Total War franchise, which is its own creature. But at the same time, it is, like I said, it's almost the best of both worlds. You have the world map, where you do all your turn-based strategy stuff, you build base, you build your cities up, you decide what units need to be built, you do your diplomacy, your tactics. But when your units clash with other units, it goes into, you can auto-resolve it, but the beauty of this game, the beauty of this series is that it allows you to do real-time strategy battle. So say if you're sieging a city, you can siege for a couple turns, build up siege units, blockade them, then attack the city with everything you've built up and all your units that are there. This game also drew some of the best elements where you have faction-specific units and perks. Depending on who you're playing as, you're going to get special units, you're going to get special benefits or negatives towards your faction, and you get different leaders that have different skills as well. The other really fun part about this is that when they designed it, they utilized Sun Tzu's Art of War in the AI design, so the AI will use those tactics against you. And you almost have to use those tactics against them. You need to know the principles of warfare in order to defeat them properly, or defeat them well, especially on the harder difficulties. Now, this series as a whole, they've focused on many different eras. They've done feudal Japan, they've done medieval Europe, and they've dealt with the Roman Empire. And just recently, they've moved into the fantasy genre as well by, of course, licensing Warhammer. So there's a bit of a fun little roundabout on that between that and the Warcraft franchise. Everybody going back to the Warhammer idea of orcs versus humans over the course of it. At this point, for all I'm only looking at the first games in most franchises, I want to look at Warcraft 3, the third game in that series, obviously. This came out in 2002. It was a step up over Warcraft 2, obviously. You had a little bit more in-game cutscenes, in-game engine that allowed for more 3D use. That's not why I want to look at this, though. It was a great game on its own. But this became the source of the MOBA genre, the multiplayer online battle arenas, which you guys are going to know best as like League of Legends, Dota 2, Heroes of the Storm, those games. They really spawned, for the most part, out of Warcraft 3. That established it for what it is. Dota, Defense of the Ancients, was a modded map created using the modding tools that are in the game itself. And it set really the base rules for the modern MOBAs that we know now. You got your three lanes, you've got your heroes, you've got your towers. And this is all because of what was in Warcraft 3 already. They had a hero unit in there that you could play in different missions that would gain levels, that would gain skills, able to use items. Because Blizzard introduced RPG elements into the real-time strategy genre, this allowed the MOBA genre to be born. And I don't think any of them would deny that modern MOBAs, like even Riot Games, would probably acknowledge that they owe a lot of respect to this mod. Now, from that little mod that just kind of made its way through word of mouth around the community, we have the MOBA genre, and I don't want to go into too much of that. It's not real-time strategy at its core, but obviously it is based off of that at its bit. I just want to touch on the big three, which are League of Legends, Dota 2, and Heroes of the Storm. So Dota 2 from Valve, it borrows some of the old support team from the Dota mod. It's brought people in from there. The way they play it is that all the characters are free because they expect you to buy all the cosmetic equipment, all the different skins and that. They don't have an in-game currency to the same extent that some of the other ones do. And that's because it's Valve. They're using this more to draw you in and become a regular user of Steam, sell you the passes for the major events, really get you hooked on it that way. The other big, I would say the number one biggest player in the MOBA genre is League of Legends from Riot Games. They developed it right from the ground up. The way they kind of hook you in is they have a rotating squad of free characters, so you get to try somebody new on a regular basis. And then you either take your time grinding in the game to earn the in-game currency and buy more units, or you can pay cash for it. And also there's cosmetic skins and all that you can drop cash on as well. Now, one of the things Riot does very, very well is they control the esports scene themselves. So any League of Legends event, if it's not run directly by Riot, they have a hand in it. They can kind of veto elements of it if they choose. And this allows them to do better branding. You have consistent branding across it. The teams know what they're getting into every time they go to play. It's one thing they've done very well. The production values really show for it. So you have a consistent production value across the whole season. One of the newer entries into the genre as well is Heroes of the Storm. And this is Blizzard joining in on a genre that really their game helped create. Now, one thing they're doing is they're leveraging their stable of brands that they've had for decades. So you have characters from the Warcraft games, World of Warcraft, StarCraft, the Diablo franchise. They've even brought in the Lost Vikings, which goes way back into their console days, and it is one of those things. I love the characters and I love the personality of the game. There's the training mission where you have Jim Raynor from StarCraft versus Diablo, and it just shows the personality right from the get-go. They too have a rotating stable of characters, so you don't get to play everybody for free. They do want you to either buy the characters or take the time playing to earn the characters. The other interesting thing they do is all the other MOBAs use player-based experience, so each character gets their own experience based on what they accomplish, plus a bit of an incoming pool from the rest of their team. Heroes of the Storm just has a team experience pool. So everybody works together, everybody benefits together. It stops a team from being dragged down by one weak player if it's just bad luck. And I think from what I've seen, it creates a bit more of a team dynamic as opposed to a toxic dynamic. And I think that's what they're trying to do, is avoid the toxic culture as well. The other nice thing is there's less minutia to the character builds. So it's a bit of a lower bar of entry than you would get with most MOBAs. So you don't have to worry about particular item combinations that you have to buy up, and you don't have to worry about the order you buy everything in and min-maxing everything. They do have that to an extent, but it's done more through individual character skills, and it creates less confusion. So instead of a stable of 50 items that you would only need to know 6 of, now you have a stable of 8 skills that you need to know 6 of, and it's a little bit easier to start playing. If I had to recommend one game in the real-time strategy genre free to play, I would probably recommend Age of Empires 2, the high-definition remix that's come out. Largely because it just works better with newer systems. It's designed for a modern display system. They've taken the core game and they've ported it to a modern setup. But the other thing is they've put out new content for it. New expansion packs have come out. The core game comes with 90% of the expansions already. And it's just a fun game. There's a reason it's still getting support. There's a reason it's still getting love to this day and age. I could recommend something from every company we've talked about. But if I had to go with just one, it's going to be AOE2. So that's it for our look at the real-time strategy genre. I want to thank you for joining me this month. If you want to reach out to us, you can do that on Twitter at Roadmap Podcast. There's also the website, roadmappodcast.com. Feel free to suggest an older game that I should play at some point. Maybe share some of your favorite memories of the genre that we've talked about. Ask any questions. If I don't know the answer, I'm happy to go looking for it. If you know some trivia that I don't know, I'm happy to learn that too. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, maybe leave a review. 5 stars always helps, but any review will help give some feedback. It's the only way we're going to get better. Next episode, at the end of the month, we're going to be playing Command & Conquer by Westwood Studios. I want to thank you again for giving a listen to this episode, and I hope you learned one or two things, or at least brought up some fun memories for you. Thanks, and I'll see you next time.